Heyo, here we go. Welcome to another episode of We Talk Music. I am your host, Mr. Brett Podcast, and I am so happy to announce that we have a special guest on the show. He is a singer, songwriter, he is a Canadian. He's released so many albums, and he just released a new album, a very good album, called Wilderness Road. Ladies and gentlemen, Gino Vannelli. How are you, Gino?
Good morning, Brett. I'm very well.
Well, that's good. We are super happy to have you on the show, and totally look forward to talking about some Wilderness Road, because it's an excellent album, and you know, your first in quite a while.
Yeah, I think the last one was 2009, and that was recorded with a lot of Dutch musicians in Holland and in Oregon. And so 10 years later, we've got Wilderness Road. It's really a collection. It started off as a collection of 35 songs, and I whittled it down to 12. And most of them were written on... I just kept the guitar on my back forever, wherever I went. And I just doodled with that acoustic guitar every day of every week until I just had a bunch of songs, and I just had to get them on record.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I know there's a lot of, I guess the way the songwriting is, it's very storytelling. Like, there's a lot of stories in the songwriting, I think. And that's something that impressed me about this.
Well, that was something different for me. I wanted to make it more of a narrative record, and it's a whole different style of writing to write from an objective or a non-editorial point of view. You just tell the story without really, you know, injecting your own opinion. Of course, you can't help but make it lean one way or another. But my penchant was more to tell the story as it unfolded. And of course, you know, to sing it was, I had to really call upon a different sense to sing it too, because when you're really singing a narrative, you can't opt for vocal acrobats or put style before content.
Mm-hmm.
So I really had to think twice about how to sing some of these songs because of the content of the lyrics.
Now, one of the interesting things about the timing of us talking in this case is that the album has been out for, you know, close to a couple of months at this point. And so I guess the question is, you can kind of see the growth and how it's and the life that it's leading so far. How is it doing so far?
Really well so far. You know, these are the days where we'll be creating videos and creating a bunch of things for the album over the next, you know, 12 months.
Well, yeah, and I guess that's an interesting question. Like, what is the lifespan of a new album nowadays, especially in your case?
Well, you know, in this case, I feel it's going to be a year before we've done everything for the record. So people know the record's out. I mean, there'll be a lot of upcoming TV shows in the United States this fall, a lot of concerts coming up, a lot more, you know, interviews and radio. The record company is going for some radio right now with the first single release. We just finished the new first video, full-length video of Giving Back My Life, which is on the record, which is just released a few days ago.
Oh, okay, then. Yeah, so when you're doing a video, like, I don't know when the last time you did a video was before this, but what's it like now, especially versus the older days?
Well, you know, the budgetary considerations are very different. In the old days, people, you would, you know, think nothing of spending $50,000, $60,000, $70,000, even $100,000 on a video. People don't do that anymore. A lot of it is because, you know, the equipment is improved. I mean, you can buy professional cameras that look, you know, that look every bit as good as cameras did, $50,000 or $100,000 cameras did in 1985, and now you can purchase them for $3,000 or $4,000. So people who have technical equipment can, you know, buy it a lot cheaper, and thereby drove down the cost of videos. But today it's more about not as much flash and how how big and how fancy your video is. It's really about communicating what's in the song. It's for me, it's more about performances. It's more about what an artist can do in front of the camera. Although there are some videos that are out there that are elaborate, I think in my case, like in this last video, my communication was the thing I was looking for, because obviously we have four or five more to do, and that's going to dictate, you know, budgetary concerns and all that kind of stuff. But it really is such a different world. You don't have the numbers that you had, you know, 30 years ago on MTV or Much Music, that they no longer exist anymore. People, you know, watch videos on their iPhones, or you know, they're just going to work, or and they'll tune in and check something out. Whereas in the old days, you know, you had to be in front of a TV set to look at a video. So it's kind of scattered in a sense, but in a way, it's really all the same. It comes down to the performance and the content of the song, production of the song, if it's something that people like or not.
And now, how big is your touring band?
Well, I try not to over tour. I do about 35, 40 dates a year. And I'm still good for a few years. I feel good on stage, and I'm happy to sing my heart out, you know. And when I no longer feel I can do 100%, I'll stop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I guess that's one of the interesting things, because knowing your type of music, I mean, and knowing that you could bring a lar that your show might be a little bit larger with a number of band members and stuff like that, I can imagine that would be a little bit more money again to bring out on the road to do a full show.
Of course. Yeah, we are 10 people that travel. It's a big full show. But they're great musicians and a lot of fun songs to sing and play, and it's still challenging. I mean, because in 99% of the cases, I've kept the same key that I did 40 years ago when I recorded the songs. So I really, really work hard to stay in vocal shape to be able to sing those songs as I sang them, and perhaps even better.
Yeah, that leads to an interesting question, like about as you age, as anybody ages, I mean, their voice certainly changes, and we've heard a lot of singers that are definitely not the same as they used to be. But I think the people that do take care of their voice, they are able to sing it sometimes differently, but in a lot of cases, I think they can do it better. And so, what has age taught you about your voice?
Oh, that's a good question. Moderation, sing a lot, but not too much. Just like if you exercise, but not too much, so that, you know, you're going to bend your joints out of shape. If you're a runner, you run, but if you overrun, your knees will go, your ankles will go. So if you sing, but don't sing too much. What I mean by too much, if you start doing 7 shows a week and you're on the road for 150 nights a year, your voice will go. There's no doubt, because it's not only your voice that will go, your general health, and your voice will follow. So you keep, you know, keeping your general health really up is really important, to feel 100% before you hit that stage. And for me, the range is pretty much the same as it was, only I can go lower than I used to. In this album, Wilderness Road, I really explored a lot of my lower range. And in some cases, I went up as high as I've ever gone up, you know, up to A flats and B flats, like I did 30 or 40 years ago. But I really like the fact that my voice has expanded. Now, I've had to work hard to keep the range, the tenor range going, because it's easy at my age to slip into just a baritone range. So vocal exercises, and like I say, keeping your general health up, and then knowing how to sing those notes in a kind of different way where they sound even better and without as much effort.
Yeah.
For instance, in the old days, we'd sing with just monitors, you know, wedges on stage. And you really never really knew what you sounded like, because there's so much loud music going on around you. And now you have your in-ears. And so you know, mine are airtight. and they're not very loud, but I hear myself very clearly, and I'm able to really tell exactly where my chords are and how much pressure I'm putting on them, and so on and so forth. So there's consideration, and if you don't have those considerations, by the time, let alone 60, by the time you're 40 or 50, your chords are gone.
Now, how much of the, I guess when you talk about the in-ears and stuff like that, how much of the rest of the band do you get?
Oh, I pick and choose what I want in the band. It's usually a lot of keyboard and drums and bass, primary rhythm section, and maybe a little bit of back vocals, from the other guys, maybe a little bit of guitar, but I keep it simple. Not too many things in my ears, and I hear some horns live from the horn section, so I don't need to hear their parts predominantly. I could just tell if they're on cue, in tune, on time, and that's all I need to hear. Just like almost, I could set it up the way I have it in the studio, so that way I could really, really measure, like I'm saying, how much pressure and to put on my diaphragm, my chest, my cords, my cheeks, my forehead, and you can really tell, what's going on. And if you can't, as I said, all those years playing in clubs and theaters and halls with wedges, with the band and guitars blaring behind you, you can't really tell. So you're really screaming, when you ought not to be.
Now we talked just briefly before the show about you performing in Hawaii and performing in the smaller, more intimate venues there. And so I'm interested from your perspective, what's the difference between like a smaller, intimate venue and the type of places that you normally play?
Well, sonically, not much because of the in-ears. I have my own world that I create, so I try to keep that consistent. I like to hear the way I like to hear on stage, whether it's a small place or big place. But as far as feel of the place, the stages are smaller, the band is tighter, the audience is a little closer. I mean, there's tables wedged right up to the stage, so if I had a dress, people would be looking under my dress. So it's kind of different. Whereas in a concert hall, there's a measure of distance from the stage to the first row, and of course to the balconies and all. Intimacy, I would say, is the biggest difference.
Now, in the case of Wilderness Road, you talked earlier about the way you wrote it and having a guitar with you all the time. And I guess I'm interested, like, is that the kind of thing that now that you've seen Wilderness Road that you would probably carry on and perhaps try to record more albums like that, or even just more albums overall?
I have a lot of songs that didn't make it on Wilderness Road, not because they weren't good songs, because I just decided that I would produce them a little bit different or sing them a little bit different. And maybe thematically they didn't exactly gel perfectly with the themes I wanted at Wilderness Road. But I've got a lot of songs, and I'm as we sit now, I've already written three or four new songs for the next record. So no, I definitely gonna go into the studio in 2020 and record another short EP or album or something that because I got some things that I really want to share with people. So it's a constant thing. I mean, there's never a week that goes by that I don't have some new piece of material.
Yeah, that must be so interesting to constantly be working on songs and I guess like to know that there's probably a certain number that they're never even really going to see the light of day. But does that ever
Yeah.
concern you, or is that just kind of like, nope, this is
No.
what I do and
No, it's kind of a carpenter can't keep track of every nail that he's banged. So I don't keep track of every word that I've thought of or wrote or every note that I've sung. But there's sort of kind of like the carpenter could say, well, see, I worked on that house and I worked on that house. And that's more the way I look at it. And also remember too that for me it's part of my daily routine. I mean, if you've ever read the Stephen King book, How to Write, he'd go down to his office, he still does, I presume, goes down to his office at 9 o'clock in the morning and stays there till 4 o'clock. And if he has a good day, great. If he has a bad day, well, that's the way it is. And you give yourself not much wiggle room. In other words, sit down and write so many hours a day, and something will happen.
So you mentioned Stephen King. So who are some of the people outside of the music industry that you look up to and you find have kind of helped you in your career? Maybe on, you know, just in a way that people wouldn't normally think of, but it kind of filtered in.
Well, you know, it's a very good question, because there are a lot of directors and writers. In the movie world, I will constantly, you know, admire Steven Spielberg for having such a penchant for the macrocosm and the microcosm. He can really, really set something on an elaborate scale and give you like a big period piece, and yet make it very personal and make the story give it a linear motion, so that you really follow it, understand it, and your emotions are satisfied. In a more simple way, I mean, Sylvester Stallone can do the same. After all these years, you know, of his movie making, I mean, more or less, some people would consider simplistic, but he does have this, you know, an eye for what it should look like, and he has his finger on the pulse as far as what how people respond. And of course, I mean, there are a lot of great, you know, directors that have done that. I really admire older directors like William Wyler, and because sometimes I look at recording an album almost like doing a movie. And how do you keep your objectivity, and how do I keep my whole vision intact as I'm getting lost in the weeds? And I truly admire them, you know, for Mel Gibson's last movie, Hacksaw Ridge. Really good movie. I mean, because it's a very difficult topic to tackle. How does one talk about someone who's a conscientious objector and yet want to partake and help in World War II, and specifically in the Pacific Islands? And so it's not an easy story to depict, and he did a great job on it. So I'm constantly on the on the search for people who do great art. And of course, all the great books by the great authors, you know, we always come across them. And if you have the patience to read Victor Hugo or you know, Melville, I mean, good luck. But there are so many people who have done so many great artistic things that I'm constantly on the lookout for them, because they, to me, they are the inspiration. And yeah, it doesn't matter what age they are. I mean, some people, Robert Frost has written some great poetry, you know, in the 70s and even early 80s.
Well, great, great art transcends time. You know, it's...
It does, or at least it gives us a demarcation of that time that they were alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I think that there's no question. I mean, if, Lord knows, if we all had time, that's the great thing that we all need more of, I guess. But so you, like, how do you find the time to do all the stuff that you want to do, plus record and all that kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's like a three balls. I have a ball of wanting to perform, and then a ball of wanting to compose, which really, it can be split in three ways, which is production, compose music, and write lyrics. And then the third ball is rest. So I'm constantly juggling performing, practicing, singing, the ball of composing, writing lyrics, music, production, and the ball of rest, total rest. And none of the balls stay in one hand for very long. They just keep circulating like a juggler juggles three balls. And that's what my life is.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's the second time that I've heard that analogy for the way that you live your life. And I think it's one of the best analogies I've ever heard for being able to understand. And I think also being able to kind of package those things that are important to you within your life.
Well, we have an allotted time, and when my son was very young, I would tell him, I stress to him, one of the things you really learn with time is time management, how to manage your time, because time is a gift. You're given this time, and what are you going to do with it? Are you going to just kind of let it wither away, wait for something to happen, or are you going to actually make something of it? Like a ball of clay, take it in your hands and shape it. Time is like a ball of clay. You just shape it to what you like, and you look at it, and when your time is up, you go, well, that was a nice thing, and therefore it was a good life.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. Now, I know I'm running out of time. If you have a couple more minutes for a couple more questions, then
Sure.
great. All right.
Yeah, no problem. No problem, Brett.
All right. Well, so one of the things you had talked about like the directors and like keeping keeping it on the pulse of what people are looking for. So how does that work with the music industry nowadays, in your case especially, because I think when we think of like the pulse of the music, you think about the Ariana Grandes and stuff like that, the top 40 stuff. But I think there's a lot of talented people that aren't looking at top 40 now because it doesn't exist in the same way that it used to 30 years ago. So how do you keep your finger on the pulse for you?
Well, I think no different than in many ways than maybe an indie director or an indie, script writer or producer, movie producer, or even a car company. I mean, if a car maker, whether it be GM, Ford, or Volvo, or whoever it may be, if they try to be all things to all people, they will fail. They need to actually perfect one thing. Go for something that means something to a set of people. And for me, I mean, I knew a long time ago it was time to really not be, part of the general mainstream of pop the way I was in my 20s and 30s. And by the time I got to 40, I realized, no, this is not something I either want, resonate with, or which is really appropriate, for me. It would be like, like wearing clothes are inappropriate, So I just get kind of settled on what I like, what means something to me, what I see is happening, in the world at large, what I like to write about, and I think that whatever resonates in me will probably resonate, and I don't know how many, but at least enough people so that I can do what I do. And lo and behold, that's what happens. That's what's been happening in the last 30 years. And so it's not a question of trying to be all things to all people. It's trying to be, good at what I do, trying to satisfy that artistic need within me. And hopefully it resonates with enough people out there so that it creates enough industry.
One of the things that I'm really fascinated about is, as a Canadian, going down to the US, especially in your early career, like, is that a real like leap of faith, like a leap of trusting your ability? Because I mean, we know now, like it's not that easy to gather a career in the United States. So how does is that was that easier back then when you started?
No, I mean, if it's easier, if it looks easier, it's only because a hindsight, seems to be seem to have 20/20 or very, very, very clear vision when we look, back. But at the time, with what I knew and who I was at 18, 19 years old, it was a leap in the dark, not because it was the United States or not because it was New York or anything like that. It's just because, number one, leaving home. Number two, I don't know where I'm going to. I don't know who's going to like what I do, if anybody's going to like what I do at all. But it's an impulse. And thank God it was a blind impulse because more the years go, the more you get to know, and the more you understand that there are pitfalls, deadfalls, there are stumbling blocks, there are hurdles that you might get hurt on. And you don't know those things as much, or not aware of them as much when you're in your teens or late teens. And that was a gift for me. So not knowing, I just went headlong and did what I was going to do. And somehow, by 20 years old, I got signed to A&M Records and was there all my 20s and made 7 or 8 records there. And that was the beginning of my career. So, I mean, you have to be willing. I know this much is true, that if you're not willing to take a step, the universe tends to not respond. There's nothing. I mean, the universe tends to respond when you're willing to take that leap of faith, or not even calling a leap of faith, take a risk. And it may respond in a way that you're not expecting, as it may pay you in currency that you're never expecting. And it may first pay you with pain, but that pain may lead to great gain in the future, because it may lead to wisdom of knowing what to do at the right time. So I know nothing is done, nothing gets done if you don't first take that step. And whatever that step is, it cannot be a step made out of caution. It's got to be a step made out of desire, wanting to complete yourself, wanting to express yourself in a way that is human, in a way that is our gift, that is the thing given to humanity, that we love to express ourselves from the cave drawings, of Neanderthal to the greatest art form you can, to Dali. We love to express ourselves. And when we don't express ourselves, we get all pent up and we get all frustrated and we even turn hostile towards ourselves and each other. So I think the best thing a man can do or a woman can do is to take stock of themselves and say, I'm going to do this. I'm going to express myself in this way, whether it's art or whether it's, accounting or whatever it is. It's the form of your own self-expression.
Wow, yeah, that's really, yeah, it's I like I'm really enjoying talking to you, Gino. I like this this kind of train of thought, because there's no doubt that I think as we progress, the more that you put yourself out there, the more that other things open up, things that you would never have ever seen foreseen as you started out along the road. And so I guess, as you go through your music, like, where are those things now? Like, where you're putting yourself out there and maybe making an impulsive decision, and those unforeseen things that happen that kind of, carry you through.
Well, I mean, I think all is made right when a person, in this case, an artist, stays interested. The minute you're disinterested or dispassionate or you're apathetic, you're like a flower whose petals are just closing up because the sun's going down. Interest creates light, and light creates life. When you're interested, you delve. You delve into books, you delve into art, you delve into paintings, you delve into what people did then, philosophy, politics, religion, theology, metaphysics, the humanities. You delve into things, you delve into the realm of human thought, human endeavor. Why did this happen, historically, and how did people feel, and what happened really 3,800 years ago during the time of Moses, and how did it lead to this, and why are the Ten Commandments still posted on most in most courthouses, and how that affected us? I mean, when you study the line of history and the trail that we leave behind and the fire that we put forward, it's really a fascinating part of our own evolution, our history, our present, and our future. And I became very, very interested in all that. When I started studying theology, it led to, obviously, first it was academic, but it later led to more hands-on kind of theology practice, whether it be scientific practice, like, you know, an extrasensory deprivation tank, or meditation, or some form of prayer, or some form of group study, or whatever it is. It's fascinating to see how what people need, what people do, how people act, react, and that feeds my artistic sense a lot. And without it, I'd have nothing to say. And some of it's good, some of it's not so good. But I suppose I judge it, but I don't I discount it, even though it's not good. I just look at it as a part of the human process. It's the same way I feel about all religions, all philosophies, even politics. It's just really part of who we are. And we go back and forth, and we try to say this or try to do this, and sometimes we're right, sometimes we're wrong. It seems chaotic, but just like a lawn really is, there's no blade of grass that's the same as the other blade of grass. And if you look really closely, the lawn will look pretty chaotic. But if you look far enough, if you have the right perspective, it'll look pretty uniform, and somehow it works. And somehow everything humans do works in tandem, because the saying goes, for every action there's an equal and opposite reaction. So a study of all those things has really, really informed me and kept me interested. I'll go back to my first statement that to stay interested is to keep a light shining on yourself, and information comes to you, and not only information, a sense of yourself, a sense of where you are, who you are, and the rest of humanity, and indeed, the rest of what you project, in our galaxy and far beyond, becomes available to you because you're interested. You want to know, and you're not just kind of giving up on life. I kind of look at it this way, the sun and the moon and the planet and all the other orbs, in the sky don't give up on themselves, so why should I?
Now that makes really good sense, and I guess it would really inform your music and certainly your life in such a different way than somebody who would close themselves off to these kind of learnings.
Yes, and that's why there are songs like "The Woman Upstairs" or "The Long Arm of Justice," or "Yet Something Beautiful." That's why there was those kind of songs on the record, because I mean, it's not easy to write about a boy at 5 years old who's been kidnapped, and about a killer who gets away with it in a song form. But I used what I was telling us, that it's information, and I felt something about it, and I came to some conclusion. And then I could say subtle conclusion is that a man may not be tried for his crimes, but I believe a man will see his destiny by virtue of his nature.
Yeah, and
And
you, oh, sorry.
no, it's going. It's okay. Go ahead.
Well, you mentioned the woman upstairs, and I had read your blog on your site about that, and so yeah, it's interesting because when you have a blog like that gives that backstory, then I think it does bring out more to the song.
Of course, and I had that, in my head for a long time, because it was a true story, that, I mean, it really happened, in the apartment upstairs. And as a young boy, it stayed on my mind for many years. But it took me a long while to decide to write about it. To tell you the truth, 20 years ago, I wouldn't have known how to write about it. But with time and age and maturity, I could stand back and just talk about it, without getting all crazed about it and start, raising my arms and saying, "Oh, the injustice of it all." I didn't want to do that. I wanted people to realize the injustice of it without me saying it. And that way, it's more of a participatory kind of song. When an artist injects his outrage or whatever it is, it's much less interesting. I'd rather be outraged all on my own. If I'm listening to a song or reading a book, I really was influenced a lot by Anton Chekhov's playwriting. He'd write these great plays and never interject his own emotions. as Isaac Bashevis, a singer, a great short story writer. And I read a lot of their works, and I said, you know, I don't know how they do it. I got to learn how to do this, where I'm feeling all these emotions, and they're not actually, you know, insinuating any emotion at all in their writing. They're not being emotional at all. It's all below the surface. It's all in the content. It's all in how it's unfolding. And well, it's a powerful thing to be able to write that way. I think I accomplished it in some of the songs on this record, and Woman Upstairs is one of them.
Yeah, that's it's so true. And the more that I think back about it, the more that I can, yeah, I can really see that as we talk about this. So yeah, is there like a desire to write more about the songs to give people those kind of interesting back histories?
That will be happening. That will be happening over the course of a year. On this latest little blog on Give Me Back My Life, it just came out the video. I gave people a little background and that it was the third try, and that I ended up taking a much lower key because I want to experiment with other sounds on my voice. And so there's a little bit of background that will be happening to at least a good many of the songs over the next 12 months.
Well, I tell you, I look forward to reading them. This, you know, what a fascinating conversation, Gino. Thank you so very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Well, my pleasure, Brett. And you know, just the best to everybody out there. And it's a cliche, but follow your heart and listen to your logic. Those two things will lead you on the right path.
Yeah, I can see that. So, we give everybody a chance to tell the fans where they can find your work, where the best place it is to kind of, you know, connect with you in that regard. So please do that.
Well, I mean, GinoV.com is my official site website, but I do participate, and I do personally participate on Facebook, so they could follow my Gino Vannelli Facebook page, and there's a lot of information there. A lot of the blogs are there. There's about 40 or 50 blogs that I've written over the course of 4 or 5 years, and all the new works, the new video is there, so they can check out, you know, what we're doing on the Facebook page.
Well, I'll tell you, yeah, I mean, I love your website and your Facebook. Like, I love the fact that it's so robust, 'cause there's, you know, so many artists don't put that much work into their promotion and this kind of thing. So I love to see when somebody is out there actually doing this, because it does help bring a fan closer, no doubt about it.
It does, and I like to read some of the comments and all that, and because it's feedback, and sometimes I'll reply. The comments on this record, most of them are exactly what I hope they would be. People are understanding it in a way that I hope they would understand it, and that to me is a kick. Still, after all these years of recording, that I'm able to put something out there and, first of all, have people enjoy it. Second of all, have people gain some insight that I myself had gained, you know, while writing it or right before writing it. And that's still a big kick.
Wow. Yeah, I can well imagine. Well, hopefully we get a chance to have you on again when you do a new album, and hopefully you get a chance to come to Calgary, because we'd love to see you live. I can tell you that much. And otherwise, all the best with Wilderness Road. Thank you so much, Gino Vannelli.
All right. Thank you, Brett. You take care.
All right, will do.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
I was in the neighborhood. I'm hoping you don't mind my troubling to grab a few positions I might have left behind. My kind of blue, we'd slow dance to back in the day. I had a pair of shades. Oh yeah, and baby, by the way, won't you give my life. Won't you hand me my heart? You know those few loose ends, like the earth, the moon, and the stars. Won't you give me back my world, my sole reason to be? Mind if I look around, please, for the missing part of me? Give me back those nights, every kiss, every sigh. Just do that, and I will say goodbye. So sorry to intrude on you, looking like such a mess. See, you packed my bags in such a rush, I forgot to pack my happiness. Won't you give me back my life? Won't you hand me my heart? You know those few loose arms, like the earth, the moon, and the stars. Won't you give me back my world, my sole reason? Part of me, give me back those nights, every kiss, every sign. Just do it, and I will say good.